So, welcome everyone. Thank you for being here. So, my voice is down in the lower registers today. I have a summer cold. So, if you can't hear me, just wave at me and I'll try to get my voice up. Okay. So, the title of the talk this afternoon is Retreat with Rinpoche. And this last weekend, I was up on the Cumberland Plateau on retreat with Kenpo Suwong Dongal Rinpoche, who is the teacher for the Padmasambhava Tibetan group. This is the first retreat that I've been on since just right after my wife Kathy died, almost 3 years ago. So it was kind of a big deal for me to go on this retreat. And when I first got there, and I want to tell you, this is way out in the back of beyond. I mean, it is really out there in the country. A farmer became attracted to the Rinpoche's teaching and gave his group a chunk of land, and they have built this extraordinary Tibetan temple, which is just out in the middle of nowhere. I don't know if you've been to Monterey, Tennessee in a long time, but or I hadn't been there in a long time, and it really was a picture for me of what's been called the hollowing out of America, just the kind of slow deterioration of small-town America. It looked like kind of a dying town. But here was this very lively Tibetan retreat, which was going on down the mountain. So when I first got there, I went into the temple to find a place to sit, and I was just blown away by the beauty of the place. And if you know anything about Tibetan practice, there are gorgeous fabrics that they use, a lot of statuary of different Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. There's incense there, and there are bells. It feels very Catholic if you have some familiarity with that Catholic Christian tradition. And so I felt right at home, because the liturgical traditions, whether Orthodox or Anglican or Catholic, have this kind of vibe, this sort of feel to them. It was a real feast of beauty, and there was a warmth to the place. One way to think about these different Buddhist traditions is to think about their kitchens, about the way they cook. If you're in a Zen kitchen, I mean, everything is really lined up. Every knife is right in its place, and it is just very precise. In fact, the Zen folks say, you should treat every grain of rice as though it were the body of the Buddha. That is a very kind of precise, attention-paying way of being there. There is a Netflix film that comes from the TV show Chef's Table. Any of you want Chef's Table? So I'm not a devotee of Chef's Table, but my stepson Cecil is. And it's the third season, and there is a Korean Buddhist nun. Her name is Jung Kwon. And I mean, really big deal chefs from all over the world have come to watch this woman cook. But what's really extraordinary is the juncture between her cooking life and the story of her life. So I really want to invite you to look at Chef's Table Season 3. So there's kind of the Zen side of things. On the Tibetan side of things, it's a party in the kitchen. I mean, they are talking and they are having a good time. So in this temple, you know, where, you know, this feast of beauty is, they're actually on the behind the altar, in a wall behind there, they're cooking for the Rinpoche. I mean, this would never happen on an insight meditation retreat where it's just pristine silence. But there with the Tibetans, it's just no problem at all. I have to tell you about the presence of the Kenpo. The Kenpo and his older brother, who was 10 years older and who died just a couple of years ago, they made their escape from Tibet when the Chinese communists took over. And I think they left with a party of, you know, something over 100 people. And I think maybe 5 or 6 of them made it in their trek over the Himalayas and made it out to India. And so these two brothers were, I mean, they were brothers, but they were really bound to each other. The older brother really grew up in the last of the formation of Tibetan lamas. And he was known in the Nyingma tradition, one of the 4 Tibetan schools, as a great scholar. He died a couple of years ago, and his reincarnation has been found, and I'll tell you a little bit about that story later on. But to be in the presence of the younger Kenpo is... His samadhi is so deep. His meditative concentration is so present and so deep. You feel like you are just being drawn into the energetic vibration of this. The structure of the retreat is really quite different from any Christian retreat, centering prayer retreats, or insight meditation, Vipassana retreats that I've been on. There's a lot of silence in that style of retreat. But in this retreat, what happens is occasional silence, but really what happens is a lot of chanting in Tibetan. And so there are these chant books, and I mean, I was totally lost in these chant books, but the people who were sitting beside me were very kind and would show me, you know, kind of which chant we were on at a particular time. And you really fall into the rhythm of this. The words are translated below the Tibetan, but you don't have time to read the words. You're just trying to keep up with the Tibetan words. You know this one, Om Mani Padme Hum. Everybody knows that one, or most of us do. But these chants are they're more than hypnotic. There is some kind of transmission, and the musicians in here will get this. There is some kind of transmission that is going on through the vibrations of these seed sounds. They call them the seed sounds. The Om sound, for instance, is the primordial sound which birthed the universe into being. Say in the biblical tradition, you know, God spoke the world into being. And it's these sounds that bring the world into being. The word Rinpoche, you know, there is Kinpo, that's a Tibetan of high scholarship, Suwang Dongo Rinpoche. The title Rinpoche is an honorific, it's like reverend, but it means precious one. And the reason that these lamas are called precious ones is because they are embodying the clear light. They are passing on through their being what we all essentially are, but have been put to sleep by the obscurations of our consciousness. These Rinpoches are very much awake to this, and so to be in their presence is to have something in you awakened. You talked at the meals, unlike the silent meals in my regular retreat experience, and so I had a chance to get to know a number of the people there, and they were very warm and friendly, and there were lots of Christian refugees there. People who had made their way out of the more shaming varieties of Christian experience, and who had found in the naming of the reality of suffering, that suffering is a part of human experience, and the reminding of everyone's original goodness, they had found some kind of refuge there which had not been a part of their spiritual formation growing up. So there was that group of Christians, but there was another group too, that had deep and rich experiences of love in the Christian tradition. There was one particular woman I was talking to. She was an artist. And by the way, lots of artists are really attracted to the Vajrayana, the Tibetan tradition, because it just has such an artistic feel to it. And this particular woman, she lived in Firenze in Florence in Italy. She was an art scholar and art student. And so she lived for about 5 years in Firenze. But she would make these pilgrimages to Assisi, take the train to Assisi. And, you know, there in Assisi, there's the enormous basilica to St. Francis. And then there's another church which is dedicated to the memory of Francis's companion, St. Clare, or as it's known in Italian, Santa Chiara. And this woman was telling me that she was at Mass one day, and some of her English-speaking friends had said, you need to go to Mass at Santa Chiara's. There is this there's this Franciscan monk and priest who has deep realization, and you need to be in his presence when he's celebrating the Mass. So she thought, okay, you know, how good can this be? But she said what happened to her was like this warmth came into her body, and she said, it changed me. It was like there was some kind of rearrangement, rewiring that went on in that space. And she said, I feel like that's the same thing, kind of thing that's going on when I'm in the presence of the Rinpoche. There was a young man that I particularly liked. He had become a Tibetan monk, and we were talking, and I said, what'd you do? You know, he was an American guy, and I said, what'd you do before you became a monk? He said, I was an opera singer. And I said, oh, really? Tell me about that. And he said, yeah, I was in training to be an opera singer. And he said, one day I just wandered into this bookstore, and there was this book by His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, and I picked it up and I started reading. He said, on such little things does a life change. So one of the high points of the retreat was that he was chanting the Heart Sutra for us. So he's got this wonderful operatic voice. And this really core chant, if there's one famous chant in Buddhism across the different schools, it's the Heart Sutra. And so Lobron, that was his name, was chanting the Heart Sutra, and it was really sweet. The piece that I want you to catch out of my experience are two words. It's devotion and bodhicitta. What is so apparent when you walk into this Tibetan space is how devotion is really the key to the whole deal. There's this opening of the heart, and part of it's the devotion to the teacher, to the guru, to the lama. But it's also devotion to the Dharma path as well, to the liberation that comes through studying the Dharma. I think you see that devotion in many Christian settings. You can see it in the Jewish mystical tradition. It's certainly there in Sufism. I mean, the heart-opening practices of Sufism are all about devotion. But it's interesting that a lot of the early American practitioners of Buddhism, in whatever flavor, whether it was Vipassana or Zen or Vajrayana, Tibetan Buddhism, these were people who had grown up in Catholic or Jewish traditions. And something had gotten for them kind of rigid, frozen, formalized. And as they came into what for them was something lively in this tradition, it woke something up in their hearts. So there's this devotional quality that I think there's a warmth to it that you don't see in Zen practice, and you don't see, I think, in insight meditation practice. But the other word is this Sanskrit word bodhicitta. And bodhicitta translates as the awakened mind heart. If you ask the Tibetans where the mind is, they point here. That's where the mind is. It's not up here in the skull. It's here. And the point of practice is to awaken to what is already there. It is this clear light of wisdom and compassion. And that's what the Rinpoches embody and want to awaken us all to. The most significant moment of the retreat did not happen when I was in Rinpoche's presence, but I think he set it up. I was the motel where I was, actually it was a bed and breakfast where I was staying, was about 20 minutes from the retreat center itself. And so I would drive up and back in the morning and in the afternoon at night. And Saturday morning I was driving back down to the temple, and I happened to have some Tara chants. Tara is the mother of Buddhas. She's the feminine embodiment of the divine, one of them in Tibetan Buddhism. She's Kuan Yin in China. She's Canon in Japan. Same figure, different names. So I was listening to these different Tara chants. There's the Dalai Lama, chanting Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha, Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha. That's her chant. But there was an American group, two women called Hark, and they are from a group called Anonymous Four. Some of you know their chanting. They do sacred chants from across the great spiritual traditions. And so these two women were doing this chant to Tara. And I know there was a connection to Kathy because Kathy loved Hark's music and she loved this particular chant. But as I was driving down the mountainside and onto this gravel road back into the holler where the retreat center was, I just began sobbing. And, you know, there's some kind of weeping where there are warm tears, you know, that kind of crying. And I thought, where is this coming from? What is this about? And my experience of it, the only way I can describe it to you, was there was this feeling of maternal holding. It was this feeling of being held. And here's the story I'm telling myself about this. I don't think that experience would have been possible had I not been in the vibrational field of the Rinpoche with his deep devotion to the practice and his embodiment of this bodhicitta, this clear, pure light of wisdom and compassion. If you were here last week, I began to unpack a method in therapy called internal family systems. And one of the things I really like about this method of therapy and where I think it's so congruent with what we've been doing in here is the first thing they want to talk about in internal family systems is this axis of, they call it the self, capital S, but in Tibetan Buddhism we would call it the clear light, the pure light. It's this axis of the self, our fundamental Buddha nature, Christ consciousness, who we really are. And what happens in the course of this incarnation, any incarnation, is that this clear light, this pure awareness, just gets covered over by different, they call them obscurations, or the word they use in Tibetan is kleshas. And these kleshas are just, you know, they're the usual suspects, greed, hatred, delusion, you know, jealousy, grasping, and all that kind of stuff. All that just kind of covers over the clear expression of this pure light that we all are, that everything is. And so what we're doing in the internal family systems work is attending to these obscurations so that they can kind of step back and this clear light can just manifest. One way to think about this, I've used the image in here of the wagon wheel. You know, there's that central axis of the wagon wheel, that central core where the axle sticks through. That's just, it's empty and open. That's what this pure, clear light is. And we just invite these obscurations to just kind of step back. What typically happens is we get so blended with these obscurations, so we say, you know, I am, you know, overwhelmed, or I am defeated, or I am, you know, you fill in the blank, whatever it is for you. And we just ask these blended parts, these obscurations, just to take a little bit of a step back. I was working with somebody who's a real tough guy. I mean, he's a real tough guy. And his identity is being a tough guy. And he has needed to be a tough guy to survive in his world. He came by that nobly, as we say. But when we invite this tough guy manager part of him to kind of step back, what begins to happen is some softening. And so we can kind of talk to that tough guy part of him and just listen to what it's got to say about his experience. I mean, it would say things like, you got to fake it till you make it. Or, quit being a wimp. You know, get up and get moving. You can't just sit here and wallow in this. And so you get the feeling, I think, the vibe of the fear that if I actually attend to this pain, to this woundedness, to this trauma, that this defense that I have used all my life is just going to be overwhelmed. So we have to titrate this. We have to do it in kind of small doses so that the tough guy is not flooded. And he begins to see that it's safe to attend to. And where it really came through for this person was around the issue of confidence. Because with this central axis, there are these qualities of confidence and courage and calmness and equanimity. We know them in the Buddhist tradition as the Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes, you know, joy, tranquility, loving kindness, compassion. These are all elements of this central core axis is who we are. But the obscurations cover this over. So when we can ask them to step back, then the real deal can kind of manifest. And what this person said was, he said, you know, what I've been doing is a kind of faux confidence. You know, in order to succeed in business, I've got to present as the guy who knows what he's doing. And I'm on top of this, you know. I've got to inspire confidence. But actually, this is confidence. What he's been doing is from the outside in, rather than the inside out. When you sit with the Rinpoche, this is a man who has confidence from the inside out, and it is very humble. You know, there is no self-promotion. There is no grandiosity at all. You know, it's like the Dalai Lama says about himself. When people say, who are you? He says, I'm just a humble monk. And he's not just kind of like blowing smoke here. He's saying, that's who I know I am. So I want to read you two pieces. I want to read you a piece about Kenpo Kenshin Paulden's Mahaparinirvana, which is, it's their big word for for not just dying, but dying into nirvana. You know, when the Buddha died there at Kushinagara between two saw trees, he laid out his body between these two trees. And the understanding of his death was not just that his body expired, which it did, his form expired, but his true nature, this clear light of pure awareness of wisdom and compassion, where did it go? It fills everything. Just as with Jesus' resurrection, where did he go? He fills everything and everyone and everywhere. These are different archetypal manifestations of, I would say, the same thing. Some people would disagree with me. That's fine. So this is about the elder brothers dying just a couple of years ago. As I said, and he didn't speak any English, by the way. His younger brother, the Kenpo with whom I was sitting this last weekend, translated everything that he said. So this is the surviving Kenpo's account of the death of his brother. The day before he entered Mahaparinirvana, I asked him, shall I sleep in your room? He said, no, sleep in your own room. I don't need that. About 3 days before he entered Mahaparinirvana, he said to me, how many years have we been together? We've been together a long time. I don't have any regrets. Imagine that. I don't have any regrets. Ever since I was young, I've grown up with the Buddha's teachings. I took ordination and wore Dharma robes. I always kept up my vows. I've been studying and practicing. I've taught others whatever I know. And the two of us together have been able to perform a lot of good activities here in America and India and Tibet. We've been able to write many books. Therefore, I don't have any regrets. When he passed away, he was so calm and peaceful. At that moment, he was meditating, and he stayed in this beautiful meditation state for the next 3.5 days. So he's sitting up in the meditation posture for 3.5 days after his last breath. After he passed away and was resting in Thukdum meditation, his complexion became so clear, and he really appeared so radiant, so youthful, so brilliant. He was sitting upright in meditation, and I really thought, maybe he's going to speak. It really seemed like that. During Kinshin Rinpoche's Thukdum, several of our Sangha members heard such a big noise one night, and the sound came from several different directions. The Dzogchen teachings explain that if a big sound appears when a great practitioner passes away, this is a sign of high realization. The texts even describe that the direction of the sound, whether it occurs in the east or the west or the north or the south, indicates slightly different aspects of this individual's realization. All of this is clearly explained in the Dzogchen Tantras. An earthquake also occurred during Ken Rinpoche's Thukdum, and rainbow light appeared during his cremation. According to the Dzogchen teachings, all of these are signs of high realization. Now, the thing that amazed the younger Kenpo was that his brother had never spoken about the depth of his realization. And so at one level, he wasn't surprised by these manifestations of his brother's realization. But on another level, it was like, good grief, I never knew that he had this depth of realization. Now, the point of my reading this to you is not for you to try to go out and be spiritual athletes and to somehow be able to do this for ourselves. You know, this is not the kind of formation that most of us have. But to let you know that this kind of thing is possible in a human life, and that we too can awaken just as the Rinpoche did, to this kind of realization. I do body work with a woman named Sandy, and Sandy practices in this Tibetan tradition. And sometimes she will, on my body while she's working with me, she will put relics from her her Kenpo, who, this man who died. And she has this, you know, the world is very thin for her. I mean, she's just able to sense things that I can't sense. And she says, oh, our Rinpoche is here with us. Our Rinpoche is here. So I want to close by reading, as I have for several weeks now, from Frank Ostasevsky's book. And I want to read this because of a particular calendar coincidence. This Sunday is Father's Day, but it's also the anniversary of Jimmy Pilkerton's dying, his passing into the larger life. And I just want to say that, you know, Kathy and I started this group back in 2005, and, you know, we were just, you know, where two or three are gathered together, you know, I shall be amongst you. We were that way for a long while, and Jimmy found our group, and he said, you know, Gordon, go big or go home. Like, you know, like, make this, like, you got something to offer, offer something here. And so, you know, we wouldn't have the web presence that we have now had it not been for Jimmy. And probably most of you would not be sitting here had it not been for the seeds that Jimmy planted. So I want to read this particular piece because Jimmy has a child, Allie, with Down syndrome, and that's the connection here with this piece. This is the story of Tommy, the young man with Down, and his mother, who had brain cancer, Ethel. Ethel came to live with us at the Zen Hospice Project when caring for her at home became more than her family could manage. Her son Tommy had Down syndrome. Although he was in his young teens, his emotional and psychological development was similar to those of a six-year-old child. He visited his mother frequently, and we came to enjoy each other's company. Over the months, we developed a certain level of trust. The morning Ethel died, I called her husband, Peter, Tommy's father, and asked if he'd like to bring the family to be with Ethel's body. What should I do about Tommy? Peter asked. I suggested that he bring Tommy along. Peter hesitated, explaining that first he wanted to talk with Tommy's therapist about this. A while later, Peter called back. The therapist doesn't think it's a good idea. She told me that when she was a little girl, she went to a family funeral and was forced to kiss her dead grandmother. She thinks exposing a child to a dead body might be too traumatic. He paused for a moment, then added, I don't know what to do because Tommy is asking to see his mother. So Frank says to him, why don't you bring Tommy and invite his therapist to come too? An hour later, the hospice doorbell rang. There stood Peter, Tommy, and the therapist and a few other family members. Tommy had a small Instamatic camera dangling from around his neck. Hi, Tommy, I said. I see you got your camera. What do you want to take pictures of today? He smiled. You, Mr. Buddha, and my mom. So he went to the living room where Tommy took photos of me and the big Buddha statue. Then we went upstairs to Ethel's room. Everyone was quite apprehensive. How would Tommy react to seeing his dead mother? He and I walked hand in hand to her bedside. He spontaneously reached over the bed rail and kissed his mother on the forehead, as he had done on every visit. Then Tommy turned and looked at me, not with fear, but with innocent curiosity, and asked, where has all that gone? Form and emptiness. What was animated and full of life was now empty. Tommy could sense the absence of Ethel, even though her body was still present. A silence fell over the room. Most of the adults squirmed nervously, trying to imagine how to respond. I said what I usually do. I don't know, Tommy. What do you think? Tommy thought about it for a minute before launching into an animated description born from his imagination. The story of what might have happened to his mother included images of a butterfly emerging from a cocoon and scenes from the popular movie Terminator 2, in which human forms morph from one shape into another. The adults exhaled and relaxed. They could see that Tommy was not frightened. In fact, he was incredibly curious about what was absent. We drank tea and Coca-Cola, and we visited in a natural way. Before the family left, I asked if Tommy and I could spend a few minutes alone with Ethel. I sensed his need to be with his mother one last time. Since we had built up so much trust over time, Peter agreed. Once the room had cleared, Tommy moved to his mother's bedside again and asked a few more questions. "When you are dead, can you feel?" he asked. "I don't know if dead people can feel, Tommy, but can you feel your mom?" "Yes, I can," he said. "But she's not moving." "Yeah, when people die, they don't breathe or talk or eat anymore," I said. My simple, matter-of-fact answer seemed to satisfy him for the moment. Then I said, "Tommy, if there's anything you want to say to your mom or do for your mom, now would be a really good time." I watched as Tommy gently touched his mother's arm, feeling its texture and changing temperature. After a moment, he did the sweetest and most remarkable thing. Leaning over his mother's body, he smelled her from head to toe. It reminded me of watching a white-tailed deer fawn once on a country road. The fawn's mother had been hit by a car. The young deer moved tenderly, sniffing her mother's body with curiosity. Tommy's movements had a similar, almost primitive feel. They were completely uncensored. Of course, Tommy would still need to grieve and take time to understand the loss of his mother. But in this moment, there was nothing more that needed to be done or needed to be said. Tommy's way of knowing was visceral and palpable. I doubt many grown-ups would ever allow themselves that sort of intimacy with death. I wondered, what if death could be as natural for adults in our culture as it was for Tommy? So, one of the things I've been doing to take care of myself lately is doing some acupuncture, and it's really sweet because I get to do the acupuncture before I come here on Wednesdays, so I'm in this really chill place when I come. It's really great. But the acupuncturist was saying to me, she said, you know, lung is a place where grief really hangs out, heart and lung. And she said, you know, you've still gotten grief. She said, there's the heartbrokenness of loss and sadness. But when the lung is involved, that's a much more profound level of grief. Because when that happens, your connection to the spiritual world just gets cut. And it's a terrifying experience. And I said to her, I said, that makes more sense out of my experience in the aftermath of Kathy's dying than anything anybody has ever said to me. It just really blew me out of the water. Now, how does she know that? How did the Chinese know that? How do the Tibetans know this stuff? How does Tommy know this stuff? How did Allie know this stuff? When Jimmy was dying, I remember Allie just shook her head like, no, he's not gonna come out of this. There is this combination, my acupuncturist was saying, that is this very practical approach. She said the Chinese are just incredibly practical. You know, they want to know how do it work. But there is also this high level of wisdom realization, and it's this marriage of the practical and the wisdom that I think we see, that I see in my acupuncturist, that I see in the energy worker Sandy that I work with, and that I think that I experienced this last weekend with the Rinpoche. It is an enormous privilege that in our time in the West, we are exposed to these Eastern arts. And it's highly ironic because we probably would not have been exposed to Zen in the late 1960s had GIs not been occupying Japan after World War II. And we certainly would not have had the Tibetan diaspora had it not been for the Chinese communist takeover of Tibet in the 1950s. You know, so here are these horrible, traumatic things that have happened to these huge populations of people. And then these blessings that exist alongside them. I'm not, and I really want you to hear me clearly about this, I'm not making some facile thing that, well, you know, things always turn out right. Because that's not true. You know, there is, in the Taoist view of things, there is this mix of light and dark. And if you look at the primary Taoist symbol, you know, there's this big piece of light, and then there's this big piece of dark. But hidden in the light, there is always darkness. And hidden in the dark, there is always this piece of light. That's the way the real world works. In our linear thinking, we think A goes to B, goes to C, goes to D. That's very Western. But in this more holistic, organic way of looking at the world, there's always light in the dark, and dark in the light. So let's sit for a little bit. So it's our practice to end with sending out wishes of loving kindness, benevolence, friendly wishes, we call them. And the Buddha said, he taught that we should first send these wishes to ourselves, receive them first so that we can give them. We can't give what we haven't received. So see who's here with you in form or formless presentation to offer you their love, their friendly wishes. See who's here. And hear them as they hold you, as they say to you, may you be safe and protected. May you, my dear one, be safe and protected. May you be welcomed and loved. May you be safe and protected in every cell of your body. May you be welcomed and loved. And know it to be so because of this bodhicitta, this pure light that is who you are. in that light, you are safe and protected. Nothing can harm you. You're welcomed and loved. Touch into your original goodness, the original blessing of your life. And likewise, we send these same wishes to our benefactors, the ones who bless us, to these who sent their friendly wishes to us. We just return the favor and we say, you too, you too, you too, may you be safe and protected. May you be welcomed and loved. And know it to be so. They are safe and protected. They are welcomed and loved. They are held in loving kindness. And so we send these same wishes to strangers, people we don't even know their names, people in the news, people on the road with us, people in stores. We say to them, you may think of a particular person, the woman who checks you out at the grocery store, man who carries your groceries to your car. May you too be safe and protected. May you be welcomed and loved. It's fun to walk through the grocery aisles and whoever you see, just say to yourself, may you be safe and protected. May you be welcomed and loved. It really transforms the experience of shopping. And so we send these same wishes to our difficult people. People who are just hard for us. You're difficult for us. Maybe not for everybody, but they are for us. They irritate us, they threaten us, they frighten us, they enrage us. See who comes to mind. And see what it's like to say, may you know the beauty of your own true nature. May you too be safe and protected and welcomed and loved. If you wish your difficult person loving kindness every day for 20 years or so, it'll really change you. And finally, we send this out to all beings, all formless beings, all beings in form. We say to all beings, may you be safe and protected. May you be welcomed, held, and loved. We dedicate the merit of our practice this afternoon to the welfare of all beings, to the arising of joy and happiness and gratitude and tranquility, and to the ending of suffering. So, a couple of announcements. Rami Shapiro, Rabbi Rami, and I will be leading a one day at Skerrit Bennett this Saturday, 9 to 3:30. There's a link on our website, OneRiverWisdomNashville.org. If you just Google One River Nashville, you'll get there. And then Rami and I'll be leading a retreat the first week in July at St. Mary's. Still room on that retreat. One of our Dharma Friends groups will be meeting at 10:30 tomorrow morning at the home of Julia Autrich. Julia's home is 620 Barlin Drive, 620 Barlin Drive. So that meeting is open to you as well. Thank you as always for your generosity. You can give online, tax deductible, or you can give here in the baskets in the back. I'm so grateful for your presence. Gives me something to do on Wednesday afternoons. Keeps me out of trouble. So thank you. Have a good week.